There is the buried language, and there is the individual vocabulary. And the process of poetry is one of excavation and of self-discovery.
This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation for March 22nd, 2017. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the achievements of Derek Walcott. Derek Walcott was born in 1930 in St. Lucia in the Caribbean. He trained as a painter, but became a poet. When he was 19, he self-published his first book and sold it on street corners. His most celebrated book is probably Omeros, an epic poem that reimagines the Trojan War as a fight among Caribbean fishermen. In 1992, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Walcott died last week at the age of 87. To talk about Walcott and his legacy, I'm joined by Edward Hirsch, a poet, critic, scholar, and all-around literary lion. We're in the office of the Guggenheim Foundation, where he is the president. Ed, Walcott first got noticed in this country in the early 1960s with his book, In a Green Night. Do you remember when you first started reading him and what you thought?
I probably discovered him with Sea Grapes in the mid-70s and then read back to In a Green Night.
And what did you think of him when you first started reading him?
Well, I was thrilled by the language. I was surprised that someone with this Miltonic sound or Lowellian sound, if you will, someone with the music of poetry, the way Milton commanded it, or the way Robert Lowell did.
Or even Shakespeare.
Or the way Shakespeare did, was taking this kind of high rhetoric and using it to write about Caribbean experience. And I thought that was just really exciting.
In the mid-1980s, you interviewed him for the Paris Review, and you went to St. Lucia and spent a week with him. That's how they do interviews, the Paris Review, I guess. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience of interviewing and spending so much time with him?
Can I say it wasn't so much the Paris Review as Derek Walcott? And I got the idea of doing the interview with the Paris Review, and Walcott said he was living in Boston part of the year.
Mm-hmm. He was teaching at Harvard, probably.
He was teaching at Harvard, and then later he went to BU. He goes, let's go to St. Lucia. Uh-huh. Let's go do it there.
Right.
So then I had to convince the Paris Review.
Well, it must have been hard.
Exactly. It was a bit challenging.
Nice job. Yeah.
Anyway, it was absolutely the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it was wonderful to be in St. Lucia. Mm. And it was extremely interesting to encounter him in his home place. I think it was just different to encounter him as a literary lion in Boston than to find him in St. Lucia and what that world was. And I learned a lot by, not only was it beautiful, and everywhere I went, because I was one of the only white people on the island, everywhere I went, people would say, how's the interview going, Mon? So that was interesting for me because I just completely stood out.
Yeah, yeah.
But I got to see some things about him. And I mean, we lived on the sea, so that was interesting. Mm. Every day our interview took place there. I also learned how fluent he was in Creole and how he moved between standard English and Creole.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to see also the complications of his being in the island. That, for example, the island is 98% Catholic. He comes from a Methodist family.
Mm-hmm.
His mother was a school teacher. He comes from, I wouldn't say privileged financially, but he had a good education. And that immediately set him off from a lot of people who didn't have that education.
Sure.
And then he has some white blood in him too.
Mm-hmm.
So he was both of the island, but slightly removed from it in ways that were interesting, that I think created conflicts for him and also challenged his loyalties. But he was very fiercely partisan towards writing about the Caribbean.
And he, even though he spent years in the United States, he always thought of himself as a Caribbean poet.
Oh, no, there's no question about that. He's a writer that belongs to the world.
Hmm.
He's an international writer. He spent time in England. He was influenced by English poetry. I mean, he had a terrific colonial education.
Hmm.
And then he spent a lot of time in the United States. And he wrote about Arkansas, he wrote about the American South, he wrote about Boston, he wrote about New York, which is his first American city. But his real subject was always the Caribbean. He was always sort of off duty in a way when he was writing about other places. His real subject was the landscape of the Caribbean, the landscape of St. Lucia, creating a Caribbean literature, what that looks like, being riven by colonialism, the colonial experience, being halfway to Africa, looking towards the old world and the new world, all those experiences really is fundamental experience. I mean, he is a Caribbean writer.
In your interview with him, he talked about poetry as prayer, about how being a poet was a religious vocation. And even at the time in the mid-80s, that must have been an unfashionable thing to say for a poet. And he knew that, didn't he?
Very much so. It was always an old-fashioned notion even then. Postmodernism was in full sway.
Yeah, and he is not postmodern.
He's not postmodern.
Yeah.
I mean, he comes after modernism, so he's sophisticated. But he loved the traditional forms of poetry and mastered them quite well. He loved the sound effects of poetry and mastered them quite well. But he had a sense that he was gifted with something, and he had to be true to it. And the metaphor for the Caribbean writer has often been Adam giving names to things, Adam naming the things in the garden, because these things just, although they had names, they didn't have names in poetry, or
right.
at least in written poetry.
Right.
And I think there was a strong sense of being true to his experience and being true to the island and being true to the landscape and being true to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of poetry being a vocation, not a career, and poetry being a prayer as something that you negotiate with yourself and your God, not so much with other people. Other people come into it later. I think he had a strong sense of vocation, and it was moving to me, and it was a model for me of what poetry could be and what could do and what it meant to have that kind of commitment as a poet.
Wolcott's a poet of grand gestures, of high rhetoric. He makes me think of Shakespeare in his grand sweeping rhetoric of a lot of his poems. And that goes against the grain of a lot of contemporary poetry as well, doesn't it?
Very much so, but I think that Heath would have said that the Caribbean is performance-oriented.
Yes, he did in the interview. It's very much about the public presentation.
The public, and he goes, in Calypso, you can't afford to be too modest. You can be modest before your subject, but you'll be destroyed as a Calypso artist.
Right.
That you need to make the grand gesture.
Right.
And you need to make your play, to put your cards down, to be competitive, to throw down, as it were.
Yeah.
And I think that was always his idea of being one of the greats.
Right.
And standing on that platform. It's not ironic. It has its ironies, supposedly its colonial ironies that he's aware of. But it's not a postmodern, ironic Ashbarian stance
yes.
towards experience. It's much more sincere, I'd say,
yeah.
than that.
Now let's turn to an example of his poetry. We have a good sampling of his poems on our website, and I asked you to choose one to read, and you chose a short one, relatively short one, for Derek Wolcott called Sea Grapes. Why did you choose this one?
Maybe I have a particular attachment to this poem because Sea Grapes was the first book of Wolcott's that I wrote about.
Mm.
I think it's a sort of breakaway book for him as he starts to think about Odysseus. I mean, there are two key figures in Wolcott. One of them is Robinson Crusoe and the idea of the castaway. And in the early work of Wolcott's, the castaway is the main figure. But in Sea Grapes, it begins to change.
Mm.
And the figure starts to be Odysseus,
mm-hmm.
who's the figure that is behind Omeros and the Odyssey.
Mm.
And then later it becomes, so one of his early books is called The Castaway and The Gulf, two of his early books. One of his later books is called The Fortunate Traveler. So the work moves from being not just shipwrecked, which is the feeling you get from the early poetry in this beautiful island, but you're on your own, versus a sense that you can actually leave that island as an emigre or as an exile. And you're a fortunate traveler because you can leave, but then you also feel cut off from the place that you came from.
Mm.
And so that Sea Grapes is sort of the cusp of this change in his work.
And I guess we should be clear, Sea Grapes, I looked it up online, are a plant that's in the Caribbean, usually on the beach, and it's a small tree, and it grows kind of a grape-like cluster.
It's a tough tree that creates grapes, but it's got to be tough because it's right on the shore.
Right, right.
It digs in right at the edge of the sea.
And the poem mentions Odysseus, as you said, and then Nausicaa, also from the Odyssey, a beautiful young woman who helps Odysseus after he is shipwrecked. Here's Sea Grapes by Derek Wolcott.
That sail which leans on light, tired of islands, a schooner beating up the Caribbean for home, could be Odysseus, homebound on the Aegean. That father and husband's longing under gnarled sour grapes is like the adulterer hearing Nausicaa's name in every gull's outcry. This brings nobody peace. The ancient war between obsession and responsibility will never finish and has been the same for the sea wanderer or the one on shore, now wriggling on his sandals to walk home, since Troy sighed its last flame, and the blind giant's boulder heaved the trough, from whose groundswell the great hexameters come to the conclusions of exhausted turf. The classics can console, but not enough.
That was Sea Grapes from Derek Walcott's book, Poems 1965 to 1984. He says at the end, the classics can console, but not enough. And you can read that two ways, I thought. You could read it as great literature can console, but life is still going to be full of suffering. Or you can read it, the classics are great, but we need contemporary literature to really help us out.
I think it's a wonderful line. I often think of it because it's so truthful. It's not as if previous literature can't give us consolation, and not that the classics in particular can't give us consolation. In fact, they do. They give us deep consolation, but they aren't sufficient. They aren't sufficient to describe the world that we actually live in. And also, they can't console you enough for the lived experience. That is, experience itself will take you over.
Yeah.
And dominate. So I think it's a remarkable line for such a literary person.
Yeah.
And that's why I myself respond to it so deeply.
Right.
Because we are called to the classics. We all are called to the literature that comes before us, and it does console us. But we wish it could console us a little more. Mm-hmm. Not quite.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine from this poem why a poet from the Caribbean might be irresistibly drawn to Homer and the Odyssey. Set in another sea with a lot of islands. It's irresistible, the comparison.
I think the model there is very evident. One of the things that's striking about this poem is he refers to the one who's wandering and the one who's on shore.
And that must be the poet. He said, the funny line, wriggling in his sandals to walk home.
Exactly.
It seems like the poet or just an ordinary person, contemporary.
Well, I think it's a version of the poet. But either way, the poet can be the figure thinking through Odysseus or the one out on shore. Either way, out of this experience, the great hexameters come.
Mm-hmm.
The Homeric poem comes.
Yes.
But it's not enough.
And they're washing. There's a wonderful image of washing and dissipating along the beach. We can throw our lines of poetry at experience, but they still come to the same thing that a wave on the beach does, which is...
Ultimately, Walcott, for all his classical learning, is a New World poet.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is that he believes that the poet can transcend history, that the poet can overcome history because it's always a new world.
Hmm.
And I think the landscape of the sea gives that feeling in Walcott, which is it continually washes things away.
Mm-hmm.
It continually starts over. And there's always mourning in the world. Mourning comes back, no matter how old the world is.
There's a sense of guilt, of being torn between what he says, this ancient war between obsession and responsibility that will never finish and has been the same forever, basically. What was that? What was he torn between? What were his obsessions and what were his responsibilities?
I mean, I think that this poem very specifically is about not, thinking about the wanderer, not just the one who stays home, and the traveler, and not just the one who stays home. And I guess I would say it's the war between your personal obsession and your larger sense of responsibility. And sometimes they overlap and sometimes they don't.
Mm.
But he felt, I think, a tremendous responsibility to the place that he came from and to the people that he came from and to writing about them. And then he had his own obsessions, his own ambitions. For example, there was no publishing house in St. Lucia when he was growing up. As you said, he self-published his first three books, but he had much greater ambitions. And so when In a Green Night was published in London and in New York, he suddenly had a world to go to. And I think when he first went to London, I mean, he was educated in the West Indies.
Mm.
When he first went to London and met W.H. Auden and met Stephen Spender and Ted Hughes, when he first came to New York, he had already met Robert Lowell when he first came to New York and began to become friends with Robert Lowell and Lizzie Hardwick. I think that was, head-turning for him.
Yeah.
And then he wanted to, for many years, he earned a living in Trinidad as part of the, he and his twin brother created the Trinidad Theater Workshop. And then when that fell through, it was just too hard to make an ongoing theater company in the West Indies after more than a decade. He began to teach in the United States. I think that this conflict of going away, of being the fortunate traveler, is worked out in minuscule in Sea Grapes between the, we can supply what we think the obsessions are, but we can imagine that the obsessions and the ambitions are sometimes at war with the feeling of responsibility.
In your Paris Review interview, and I want to encourage listeners to go seek it out. You can Google it, Paris Review, Derek Walcott, it'll pop right up. But you spoke with him about funding for the arts, oddly enough. And we're talking about arts funding in March of 2017 because of Donald Trump's proposed budget, which zeroes out funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And you're president of the Guggenheim Foundation, which is a very important patron of the arts in this country. And I'm wondering if you could say a bit about arts funding and its role in our public life.
Well, first of all, let me just say about Walcott, he's completely scathing against the Caribbean middle class because there is no tradition of philanthropy in the Caribbean. And there are a lot of people with money, he points out. There are a lot of people with fantastic houses. There are a lot of people with rich cars, a lot of people who've made a lot of money, but they don't give it to the arts. They've left the arts to languish in the Caribbean, and he's completely enraged about it. One of the ironies, of course, for me then, is I was thinking, well, at least in the United States, one of the models we have is of a great feeling of state-sponsored art, of the arts commitment, and of private philanthropy, that we have a kind of public-private system. Now, my job at the Guggenheim Foundation, I wasn't the president then, I was teaching at the University of Houston, but now that I'm president of the Guggenheim Foundation, I have a front row seat at the commitment that our foundation makes to supporting individuals and to supporting individual artists. But I'd always sort of felt, because we grew up in the Johnson era, I've always felt that we haven't let down our commitment to the arts and to the humanities in this country. But now we are letting it down. Now we're becoming like those Philistines that Walcott is attacking. The idea is, what are your responsibilities for wealth in the United States? And what is the commitment of a democracy towards all the people who live in it? And I personally believe that we don't want to live in a country where all we think about is advertising and money and commercial enterprises. The arts give us a way of thinking that you can't get in other places. And I think a healthy democracy needs a healthy world of the arts. The idea is so appalling that we would cut our commitments to the endowments and to public radio and to these arts foundations that serve everyone in the country, all over the country, all kinds, not just New York City or Boston or Chicago, but people in small towns all across the United States are benefiting from our commitment as a government to the humanities and the arts. I'm just shocked that we would let down this side of the American commitment to a really thriving democracy.
Well, we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
Ed Hirsch, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You can read poems by both Derek Walcott and Ed Hirsch on our website. Do let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. You can link to this podcast on social media from SoundCloud, or you can subscribe to it in iTunes. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.